Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my regular listeners know that I have quite a few book authors on this show, and I'll let everybody know that I do actually read the books of the authors before I interview them. I think a lot of people don't. I do. I feel like I owe that to the authors to be prepared and to read through the entire book to know what they're saying and a lot of the context and breadth of their major points. I recommend a lot of books, and I'm going to tell you today, if there's one book I wish everybody could read, it's the topic today. That's how important this is. The book is called In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us. And I'm very lucky to have one of the co-authors of the book with me today. One of the authors is Francis Lee. The other is Stephen Macedo. And just to let people know up front, in our partisan divide, these are not MAGA authors. They're not resistance authors. These are two professors from Princeton University who took a very objective look at one of the major events of all of our lifetimes. And we're going to talk about that today. Stephen, thank you so much for being a guest.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sorry for that long introduction, but I just wanted to set the stage here. But
it sounded good to me.
Yeah. I mean that. I think this book, it's not just about the pandemic, it's about our democracy, and it has some very difficult lessons for a lot of us that were on one side or the other of the divide. But one of the things I found out in this book is that we actually had plans, as our government had plans to deal with the pandemic, but really didn't kind of follow them. Can you talk about that a little bit to start out here?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This was a bit of an eye-opener for us to realize this as well, that going back to 2005, 2006, really, President George W. Bush read a book about the Great Flu of 1918, the Spanish flu it was called, and worried that there would be another pandemic. Also worried a bit about bioweapons, I think, and so on after 9/11. Anyway, initiated planning processes, and there was a bit of a divide. There were mathematical modelers who were optimistic about these non-pharmaceutical measures. The focus of these reports that started then really was on what could we do in advance of discovering a vaccine or medical treatments. Would social distancing work, closing the border, contact tracing, masking, all of these things were studied for decades. And as I say, these mathematical modelers wound up being optimistic that school closures, for example, could reduce peak death rates by 50%. And they remained influential during COVID, as it turned out, the very same individuals. But there were many that studied the evidence and found over and over that the evidence for all of these measures was very weak. The term they used repeatedly was very low quality of evidence that masking would be effective, that border closures would be effective, contact tracing, business closures, social distancing measures of all sorts. And those reports emphasized repeatedly that the costs of these measures would be considerable and that those costs needed to be communicated to the public, that the public needed to be informed about the uncertainty of the evidence for the effectiveness of these measures and the certainty of the costs. There was one other thing that was said in these planning documents that was quite, prescient in anticipating what happened. They also said, and this was in a 2006 report from the Institute of Medicine, said that political leaders will be tempted to use these sorts of measures in the event of a crisis to show that they're in charge, to show that they have things under control, or to try to show that they have things under control. And I think that wound up being part of what happened as well, that once government started shutting down, that the Chinese took these extreme measures, and then Italy was the first country in the world to impose a national lockdown. Other countries copied. We find that the evidence suggests that having countries near you or jurisdictions near you that locked down was more important to predict lockdowns than the severity of the epidemic. So there was a herd effect that took place. Once some people got tough, the questions from journalists who piled on, you know, in the same way, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we imposing a national lockdown? And so on. So it was partly public health leaders. It was partly journalists who didn't question the narrative, and to some degree, academics as well. You know, we're in a business where skepticism about government policies, claims for the success of government policies of one sort or another is sort of part of our sort of job description, as it were, you know, to look for evidence to see if, well, we can really show that certain kinds of policies work. And there was a kind of suspension of the normal, you know, kind of skepticism on the part of, I would say, journalists, but also academics. The people wanted to believe that these measures would work. Of course, we wanted to do something. It was a scary virus. It was a bad virus. It was, you know, the worst since the Spanish flu. That's absolutely true. But it was exactly, you know, with an eye towards these sorts of crises that those planning documents were initiated. And, you know, they concluded in the fall of 2019, just before the COVID pandemic, one by the World Health Organization, that said, for example, not recommended under any circumstances is what the document says, border closures, contact tracing, quarantine of exposed individuals. And within a few weeks, governments around the world were imposing those measures. So it's really kind of surprising that these planning documents, decades worth, did not figure more prominently in the debate and discussion around these matters. That's a big part of what our book focuses on. Mistakes get made, but at least we should have open debate and discussion and listen to critical voices and certainly pay attention to plans like this. I'll say the UK had one, the planning document 2011. Professor Robert Dingwall, who's a sociologist who was on that planning committee, looked back and said, you know, we had the right plan in place from 2011 and we just ignored it during COVID. There's ample evidence now that the measures were very costly, just as was predicted. And it's hard to find evidence that all of those costly lockdown measures, the school closures in particular, the border closures, contact tracing, business closures, masking and so on, it's hard to find evidence that they had any significant impact on mortality.
Did these studies, Stephen, show anything that might work? I mean, you talk in the book about herd immunity, and I remember hearing that phrase, and I remember some of the dissents that I read, and I tried to read both sides back then, talked about this. Was there anything that they felt it might be effective?
Well, yes, certainly. There was uncertainty, and we still have uncertainty. We don't attempt to prove in the book and in subsequent discussions we've had, because we cite other studies as well. My co-author did a study of the 50 states, which varied quite a lot in terms of the stringency of these measures. And there were good studies of the 29 countries of Europe, which varied even more in the length of lockdown measures, the severity of lockdown measures, whether they ever closed schools. A lot of variation across countries and jurisdictions with respect to those sorts of things. When you look across them, you just don't find that the places that had longer lockdowns, tougher lockdowns, you know, more stringent measures had any benefit in terms of mortality. So there's an absence of evidence. You know, the evidence is not as good as we would like. So, you know, we don't claim to prove that they didn't work, but there was an absence of evidence for the effectiveness of these things in 2019, in 2020, going into COVID, and there is still an absence of evidence for these measures. That's exactly what the Scottish national kind of study of the COVID plan says, and we think that they're correct. So, you know, there was uncertainty. I don't want to say that it was 100% clear that these things wouldn't work. And the studies do say things like, with respect to masking, that it's mechanistically plausible. That's actually the phrase that's used. It's mechanistically plausible that a mask, you know, will help to prevent the spread of germs. Of course, there's things sneezing, you know, coughing and so on, that sort of thing. But you know, the surgical masks that were used are not used to prevent the spread of respiratory viruses. They're used to prevent a doctor from sneezing into a wound or blood from splattering in the doctor's mouth. They're not designed for respiratory viruses, let alone the cloth masks that were used or tearing a ha you know, putting a handkerchief around your mouth and so on. I mean, there's some evidence that the N95s, remember those masks that fit over the nose with a metal clip, and you really have to wear them very tightly and just breathe through the mask. Very few people were wearing those kinds of masks, and very few people were wearing them, you know, properly. You have to change them frequently. As soon as they get moist, you have to get rid of it and get a new one. When people wear these in hospital settings, their faces are disfigured at the end of the day because, you know, it really fits very tightly. In fact, they have to be form-fitted. So, sure, it's possible and probably even likely that something like that, N95 means it's 95% effective at keeping out particles up to a certain size. But the aerosolized COVID particles, and we knew this quite early on, were very, very tiny. Even those kinds of measures would be of limited effectiveness. You know, a lot of things that we did, I would say that intuitively, it seemed like, you know, they should be helpful. If you keep people apart from one another, then of course they're less likely to spread, you know, a respiratory disease. The problem is that the people that were most vulnerable, the very elderly and those with serious, you know, comorbidities, serious illnesses of some sort, they need care. They need contact with human beings to be, you know, kept well. People in nursing homes and so on, and we didn't do the greatest job in the world of protecting them. The alternative strategy to what we did was called focused protection, focusing on protecting the vulnerable segment of the population rather than shutting down the whole thing. Now, it's debatable whether we could have done that and so on. You know, most countries around the world didn't do a very good job of it, but we didn't focus on that particularly, focus on the vulnerable. And there's at least a good argument, certainly, that we would have been better off if we had focused protection on that segment of the population, which we had pretty good evidence about by in the summer of 2020, you know, that was most vulnerable and allowed kids, for example, to go back to school. Schools in Europe were open in April and May 2020. You know, just a few weeks into the pandemic, schools in Sweden and Iceland never closed. There was evidence, you know, that we could have learned from Europe about the extent to which schools were not spreading the virus and teachers were not at any special vulnerability. So Europeans opened their schools much earlier than we did, in democratic states at least, even in the spring of 2020, certainly in the fall. Whereas there was a partisan divide in the United States, and democratic states tended to stay closed much longer. And really, I think the school closures are the thing that, in retrospect, people are allowing were very costly, will have lifelong detrimental effects on many kids, especially poorer kids and minority kids, and that really we made a poor decision with respect to extended school closures throughout the 2021 school year in those places where schools were closed much of that school year.
And we're a great laboratory right here, Stephen, because we've got, you know, Illinois is a blue state, Iowa is a red state. And after the initial, I mean, it seemed like the country came together briefly
Yes, yes.
after the shutdowns and all. But as time went on and other voices were heard, this took a totally partisan path. And
Yes.
the school closures is one part of that.
Yes.
You make some really strong statements in this book, which I like, but did our government really look at the costs and benefits of the measures they were taking and how they would impact society? I mean, and I've got in mind specifically the educational divide, which is the biggest divide we have in our country right now.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, we use one example was Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, you know, who was a kind of hero because he started to do these news conferences. I live in New Jersey here. I don't know how widely they were covered, but he was doing almost a daily news conference, you know, during COVID. He won a special Emmy Award for his news conferences. And he would say things like, we quote him in the book, we need to do everything we can to prevent the spread of this virus. And if it saves just one life, it'll be worth it. Well, he repeatedly emphasized that the only thing of concern was slowing the spread of the virus and giving no attention whatsoever to the costs of the measures that were imposed, and not just costs in terms of economics, but costs in terms of basic human well-being, and you know, being able to visit again, relatives in nursing homes, or have a funeral or a wedding, and so on. The things that make life worth living, really. And we knew quite well too that the business closures, the economic impact, this people kept out of school, the impact on delinquency and so on, that those would also cost lives. So those were ignored. And we do think there was a kind of groupthink. I mean, just looking back on the evidence, a kind of groupthink among, it was partly partisan. I think it was once Donald Trump and, Republicans started reopening over the summer, that got coded as a Republican thing. Skepticism about masks was seen as a very visible signal of not just whether you care about other people, but whether you're, accept the narrative that was more prominent in Democratic states. And I think among more elite people for sure. And it did become a very partisan pandemic. That's the title of one of our chapters. Very striking divide across the 50 states. And Florida versus California would be one example of that, where Governor DeSantis mandated that the school should reopen in the fall. There were some specialized, localized closures, but for most part, they were reopened in the fall of 2020. And Florida kept closed much of the school year in California, and we don't see any benefit to California in terms of mortality. We just can't find any evidence of that. So it was very partisan, there's no question. I mean, 2020 was an election year. President Trump was on the ballot. I think that was a factor in this. There was a lot of panic, I think, among, again, educated elites who tend these days to be Democrats. So we say that as educated elites who believe in educational institutions, and we're worried about some of the groupthink and the partisanship that we think shaped discourse around these very important measures. That discussion was not as open-minded as it should have been, because educated elite institutions, including public health, universities, elite journalism, didn't look objectively at the pluses and minuses, but saw things, I think, to too great an extent through a partisan lens.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm delighted to have as my guest today the co-author of, to me, one of the most important books that's been written for our country in quite a while. It concerns the COVID pandemic. It's called In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us. Stephen Macedo is one of the co-authors. Francis Lee is the other. And Stephen's with me today, and we're going through this book, and I'm trying to get as much included as I can because this event impacted everybody. And it was, I don't think it's wrong to say it was there were some serious public policy failures here that we're looking at. I just remember the divide also was how a lot of people that went out and worked in meatpacking plants at the grocery store. I mean, they were exposing themselves to other people. But this was kind of the class divide in the United States. And the people pushing this were the ones that were able to work from home from their computers. And this doesn't really seem fair, I guess, looking back how this took place. And I think that's, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that seems to be where you and Francis go with this book.
Yeah, we think that that's true. I don't think people were quite aware or reflecting on the fact that to keep those of us who could work from home, with our electricity on, with our food being processed and delivered, transported, refrigerated, keeping the electricity on, keeping the internet on, having wine delivered when we wanted it, and so on and so forth. One third of workers had to keep working right on through in person, showing up, and for the most part, no special provision was made for the vulnerable members of that group, and I don't think we paid so much attention to that. I mentioned that focused protection on the vulnerable, those at high risk, that portion of the population was an alternative strategy. It is true that the critics of the strategies that we did adopt did say that what we did embrace was a policy of focused protection for the laptop class. I think it's a fact that we simply could not have imposed these policies 20 years ago, 25 years ago, because not enough of the economy was online. I think it was only possible to do this. This is something that journalist Matt Ridley has made this point in the UK. It was only possible to do this under current circumstances because of the extent to which a significant part of the population can work online remotely and so on. That's just something new. I think that's one of the reasons why this has never really been tried before. So I think you have a real point there. I think there was a class divide. And, look, poor people are always more vulnerable to public health threats. They have less good access to public health measures and public and care and so on. But they did suffer more from the COVID lockdowns. Again, those pandemic planning documents that we discussed before pointed out that minority kids and poor kids were most likely to suffer the most from the school closures, that business closures and so on would also have a class impact. And that does indeed seem to be what happened. Indeed, the American Civil Liberties Union, a very progressive organization focused on free speech issues, they focus on other things as well now. They did a report in 2008, warning that these sorts of measures would be especially burdensome for the poor, and minority communities would suffer from mandatory measures. And I will say the American Civil Liberties Union was completely quiet during COVID. Having written this eloquent report in 2008, three professors from Boston University for the American Civil Liberties Union, also warning about silencing free speech and so on, which there was some suppression measures that way. The American Civil Liberties was entirely silent on these policies during COVID.
I want to hit a couple more things here before we run out of time. But one is in a democracy, we are to welcome dissent, dissenting views. And you've touched on this earlier. I wanted you to expand on it a little bit. It really, and I remember that. I mean, I kept hearing, follow the science, listen to Fauci. And if you didn't do that, you were really looked upon poorly. And I will admit, sometimes I was guilty of that. And I look back on it. I feel bad. We didn't really treat dissent very well during this period, did we?
Now it's true. I mean, there were various forms of censorship and censuring of individuals, that took place, I think, on an interpersonal level. Those who wore masks were very scornful of those who didn't wear them properly and so on, the 6 foot distancing thing and so on. We were very concerned about our personal space and other people, being vectors of disease. And then at the more policy level, there were people who had dissenting views who were echoing, what was said in these pre-COVID pandemic planning documents and making those very same points during COVID. Some of them were academics, some of them were public health people, some of them were just doctors and so on. And in many cases, they were treated very unfairly. There's a professor at Stanford University, Scott Atlas, who went to work in the Trump administration to advise because he thought that Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci and others were not really following the empirical evidence on these matters. And he's a bit of a hothead and, maybe could be a little abrasive in some ways, but he was driven by the evidence and making perfectly reasonable points about the cost of school closures and so on. And he was formally censored by the Stanford faculty, for being outside his lane because he wasn't an epidemiologist. He'd written five textbooks on public health. And the people doing the censoring were professors of theater studies and so on who were bringing these charges. So it was kind of crazy, in my opinion. And there was not enough open dissent. We also know that the Biden administration got in touch with social media companies and threatened them if they didn't algorithmically suppress messaging at odds with administration policy and boost pro-administration messaging. So the whole discussion on social media was in some ways distorted by these secret interventions, which have been revealed in court documents by the Biden administration, and to some degree starting before actually the FBI and others. There was pressure on social media companies to kind of suppress dissent. I know colleagues at Harvard who wrote a piece in an education journal, and all of a sudden the education journal kind of disappeared from the internet. It just lost its visibility. And the suspicion is that it had something to do with being algorithmically deboosted, as they call it. So there were lots of ways in which discussion was not as open as it should have been in retrospect.
The really discouraging thing for me too is at a time when, I'm old enough to remember when our public had a lot of confidence in our institutions. You and Francis make a comment here that the policy errors here were similar to the Vietnam and Iraq wars. That's really bothersome to me, but I think it's accurate. And this just feeds this distrust of institutions, which somehow we have to get back in our democracy.
Yes. So, I think you're absolutely correct about that. In fact, I'm just rereading David Halberstam's book, The Best and the Brightest, which is about
Oh,
all
yeah.
the
That's a
people that went to
classic.
it. It is a classic, who advised the Kennedy administration from Harvard and so on. And they never reconsidered the assumptions that they went into Vietnam with. But some people have said to us, don't you feel a bit uncomfortable, that your book is coming out? This came out in March this year, coming out at a time when the universities are being attacked, science is being attacked. Don't you worry that you might give aid and comfort to those who want to undermine science and universities? Well, the way I put it is a premise of those attacks on science and universities is that they're politicized. And unless we're open and honest about the shortcomings and the mistakes that have been made, we just prove the premise that they're politicized. So I think the best tack is to try to be as self-critical and frank with each other as possible. And to try to do better and to recognize mistakes that were made. I mean, some of them were made under the conditions of panic and uncertainty and fear. Fair enough. I mean, mistakes are going to get made. But we could have learned more quickly than we did. Why did we keep schools closed so much longer than European countries? And I'll tell you, there's another very good book on this by David Zweig called An Abundance of Caution, which came out a bit after our book and focuses on the school closures in particular. It's also a very good book, and I would also recommend that to you. It's a very well-written, very well-researched book, and he really focuses on the school closures in particular. But we do need to learn from our mistakes, and I think we need to try to make sure that we're not biased and partisan when we are pursuing what we hope is the truth in a fair-minded, objective way, and be fair to the evidence and be fair to our opponents in debates.
I've got about a minute left here, Stephen. I mean, one of the great triumphs of this was the development of the vaccines that under Trump. You got to give credit for my Democratic friends out there. You got to give credit where credit's due. But do you think we're prepared if we have another pandemic, which I keep reading that there's a decent chance of that? Have we learned our lessons? What do you think in about a minute or so here?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it's a very good question. Some of it has to do with the cutting and funding of mRNA research. I'm not going to comment on that. I haven't studied it particular. I don't know that we've digested the failures of COVID policy. And I will just add that we have a discussion of gain of function research that's going on in labs around the world, and that continues to go on. So there's very good evidence, or at least there's decent evidence that that virus was created in a lab that the U.S. government was funding. We don't have time to talk about that, but that research on making viruses more dangerous continues to go on in labs around the world. That is another thing that we should be more concerned about and debating more openly in public.
That was another story that came out when I remember when they thought that I remember Senator Rand Paul was vocal in saying this virus could have started in a lab, and he was kind of shouted down. And yeah, I think your points in this book again that we didn't treat dissent the way we should have. Our institutions failed us. And I guess just in concluding here, that's why this book is so important for democracy. And I have to say, I'm a little suspicious that it hasn't gotten more publicity in the media because I think this book takes a fair-handed look at what happened during this COVID crisis and tries to point out where we fell short, but how we can do better in the future. And I think you and Francis have done a huge public service by writing this book. I really feel strongly about it. Again, Stephen Macedo has been my guest today. He's co-author of this book called In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us. Stephen is co-author with Francis Lee. I can't endorse this book enough to my listeners out there. Stephen, thank you so much for being my guest.
Robin, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation and really appreciate what you've said.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.